4:55, September 11th. Okay, we begin. There was a comment, I spoke with somebody in the hall about still not having books. Is this a problem for getting the homeworks done tonight?
They called me and got me my book last week.
You got a book?
The book you have is the same book that I took back because it was gone.
Are you sure? It looks perfectly fine for the homework.
You don't want the Tannenbaum book. You want the
Rose, fifth edition.
Kuros and Ross.
Yeah,
fifth edition. Jared?
I still didn't get it.
Didn't get it. Problems doing the homework based on not having the book?
Yeah,
well, probably. if you're stuck, email me. But otherwise, go ahead and turn them in. Let's move things along. Other questions about where we stand here? So the 350, I think it was the 355 class, suggested something here. Worked pretty well. Do that. This. What do you think? That's pretty good. I think we actually did it more so it's not in your eyes. What do you think? I don't know. One way to do things. So we were talking about domain name service, and we had got to the distinction between authoritative domain name servers and other domain name servers that may just have cached information. They're helpful. They speed things up, but they don't necessarily tell you the truth. And so... when you need to know the truth, authoritative is where you need to go. One example of a non-authoritative name server is a local name server that anybody can run. Right? You can start up and run a name server on your own computer. Use it to answer queries from your friends, point your friends' default DNS to your server. Doesn't matter. Your server just is then responsible for doing the lookups in the overall domain name service system. So typically, this is how you set things up. An ISP a local ISP will set up a domain name service. It will be authoritative for the stuff that's related to that ISP's names, but it will be non-authoritative for all the rest. And everybody goes through it. So I overheard a story here about how somebody tried to disable somebody's network service by turning off their DNS. Well, no help at all, because you can point your computer to use any domain name server there is. If it's willing to answer queries, you just go on working. So when your computer makes a query to a DNS server, we talked about how this process worked of you have to sort of work through the levels of the names in order to find out the ultimate destination. That can occur in two different ways, called the iterated version and the recursive version of name lookup. So iterated name service goes like this. Your host makes a query of some non-authoritative name server. And that server says, I don't know the answer. And the way I have to find out, of course, is start with the top-level domain and work my way down. Start with the root servers and then work my way down until I get to what you're looking up. So the requesting host makes a request for, I guess we're looking up this name, gaia.cs.umass.edu. makes a request of its local server. The local server queries the root server for the top-level domain server. Number four, queries the top-level domain server for EDU. This is the server for EDU. So queries this for UMass, queries this for CS. UMass. Okay? And then that provides the ultimate answer as to where what the address is for Gaia. Alright? So that's the iterated style. The idea is that the originating name server makes all of the queries. We contrast that with the recursive version, where the originating name server queries the root server, which queries the top-level domain server, which queries the... Okay, so by making one query, the local server gets the answer. Okay, but the problem with that is that the root server then, which is sort of at the root of 500 million hosts, is inundated with work associated with doing all these queries. So one of the things that you a DNS server can say is, I'm not willing to do recursive queries, and then the querying server is forced back to an iterated query. Questions about that? Caching. Okay. So name server entries get cached. Each entry is accompanied by a time limit over which it's promised to be valid, and so the cache servers eject things from the cache when the time goes by. It's simple enough in concept. The details are worthy of an RFC. So what's in the name server? What kind of information do we store in the name server, and how does it get there? The contents of the domain name service are stored in things called resource records. And a resource record comes in various types. Interesting ones that have been around forever are A records, which are mappings between names, and the value here is an IP address. So when you want to look up www.wsu.edu, somebody has to tell you the IP address for that. That's found in an A record. Type NS records are like A records, except they're for name servers themselves. And the interesting thing about the name server records is that they actually exist in the servers at the next higher level. Right, we'll see how that goes here in a second. So suppose we're at the point of wanting to look up www.wsu.edu, and I've got to do here something here. We're trying to look up www. Trying to write down www.wsu.edu. All right. So the standard thing is you look up edu in the root servers. You look up wsu in edu. And what do you find out about wsu.edu from the root server? You find out from the top level domain server. The TLD tells you the name server for wsu.edu. Right? It doesn't tell you where www.wsu.edu is. It tells you where the name server for wsu.edu is. And then you have to go ask that name server, where's www? All right? So the A records for wsu.edu are in wsu.edu's name server. The NS records are in the EDU, in the EDU server. I see that right. Okay, so those are name servers. C names are kind of cool. They're mappings from names to names. Right? So instead of like an A record, the value is a number, IP address. Here the value is a name. Right? Another, a different DNS name. So you can ask about one name, it'll tell you I don't have an address for that. Instead, look up the address of this other thing and use it. It's called indirection. Powerful principle in systems design. And finally, MX stands for mail exchanger. And early on, people decided this needed to have a special record type associated with it that A records just wouldn't do, that we wouldn't standardize on a particular name for mail servers, but rather we would standardize on a record type. Right? So when you want to find where to deliver mail to somebody at wsu.edu, you look in the name server to get an MX record. Chad?
What's the difference between an NS record and an SOA record?
An NS record and an SOA. I think the SOA record tells which server is actually responsible for the content of the domain, as opposed to being a server that will serve the content of the domain. Right, so SOA records tell you who you should tell the NS servers who they should believe about who owns this domain. Okay, I think. Right. So how do you query DNS? Use the DNS protocol, of course. I think the most interesting thing about this protocol is that it has a convention by which you can associate replies with queries. So this can run over UDP. Remember, there's no reliability associated with UDP. You just sort of fling out a message, and sometime later you may or may not get back an answer. So this identification number here is the way that queries get associated with responses. So you fling out a query with a particular identification. Sometime later you get back an answer with the same identification, and you assume that is the answer to the question that you asked with the same number. That's been used to do some security exploits, because it's a small number, and if somebody can guess the number or see the number, they can provide bogus answers. So secure DNS is a hot topic these days. The only other thing I want to say about DNS is that, unlike the other protocols that we've looked at, it's not really a pure text protocol. It uses some clever coding structures to reduce the size of the messages. So instead of seeing the actual answer to your question laid out in here is the story about www.wsu.edu, the messages themselves may contain a little dictionary that says, at position such and such, you'll find such and such a string. In position such and such, you'll find such and such a string within the message. And then the client actually has to tear that apart, that encoding apart, and put it back together to make sense of the answers. So you can't just interact with a DNS server over Telnet like you could the other guys.
Okay, so just to wrap up with the NS, the idea here, the problem we're addressing is, suppose that you want to put a new domain into service, and the one we're assuming it is networkutopia.com. We want to go into service as a new business using that domain. What do we have to do? So, well, clearly we have to tell the folks at .com about ourselves, right? So that Network Utopia gets entered into the .com level of the database. What do we have to tell them? We have to tell them the name servers that we're going to use to serve the networkutopia.com domain. And so what do they put in? They put in two the resource records describing the DNS servers. Like I said before, right? That's what they got to know in order to glue things together down the road. So what do they say? They say that those two records say networkutopia.com is served by dns1.networkutopia.com, and that's an NS type record. That's the name server. And then we have to be able to find that server without ever looking up anything in that name server, because we, you know, it's a chicken and egg problem otherwise. So .com also has to record the address of that DNS server and be willing to tell people about it. And then finally, in our own name servers, we can put in whatever hosts we want to have, and we can have a mail exchanger record if we want. Okay, so how do people get the IP address? Well, they go through that dance that we went through before, right? Either a recursive query or an iterated query of the domain name service system. Okay, I think that's all we're going to do with Chapter 2. Take a look at the protocols that we skipped over. FTP is interesting just because it's a little bit broke in how it works. That was the main one, I think, that we skipped. Any other questions about this? Okay, so let's move on and talk about programming. Okay, so this is moving to the other book, the little paperback book. I think it's a very nice little book. Handy thing to keep on your shelf even after this class is over. It's probably better to keep that one than to sell it back. I wouldn't necessarily say the same for a textbook, but it's a handy reference as well. Okay, so what we're going to talk about is it has got a little bit of review about what we've talked about before. It's got a little bit of preview of what we're going to talk about next, but all in all, it's supposed to give you enough information to write programs that use the network. So we're talking about programming for the Internet Protocol. As we've observed before, that what happens in the Internet is a host produces a packet, it puts an address in it, and sends it off into the network with the hope that it will be delivered. And, of course, it works well when packets get delivered with high probability, and works badly when they don't. Okay? So that's called best effort service. It allows for loss, reordering, duplication, delay, all things that you really don't want to have happen. But it turns out that by choosing to allow those things to happen, it was possible to build the internet easily, right? You can actually build a network with these properties much more easily than one that avoids all those things. And so it turned out to be cheap and easy to expand, and it was overall a good thing. The other thing, and we've mentioned this before, that the internet really provides, the IP protocol provides host-to-host delivery. It doesn't provide delivery from one application to another. The addresses at the IP layer are just of a host, not an application. What are the addresses? They're 32 bits, and the convention that has evolved in the internet is to write them as 4 decimal numbers. In dotted note, in so-called dotted quad notation. Okay, so we don't use hex. We don't use. We don't try to write them as one big number. Well, I should say that each of these decimal numbers is from 0 to 255, representing 8 bits of the address. That's. They're not like commas in decimal numbers or something there. It's an 8-bit byte, an 8-bit byte, an 8-bit byte, an 8-bit byte, making up the 32 bits of the address. So I lied a little bit on the previous slide when I said that it the internet delivers packets to hosts. It really delivers them to host interfaces. A computer that has more than one host interface may have more than one IP address. Doesn't have to, but it may. Okay. And everybody should be familiar with that these days, right? You've got an Ethernet port on your computer and you've got a wireless port on your computer. They have different IP addresses, typically. Okay, so the best effort service provided by IP is not sufficient. We really would like to have some assurance that when we send a bunch of bytes from one host to another, at least in some situations, that they all get there. That's one thing that we need. And the other thing we need is we need application addressing. So we'll take those in opposite order. User datagram protocol, UDP. I don't know that I'll ever say user datagram protocol again in this class. It will just be UDP. UDP is a transport protocol, then, layered on top of IP. We talked about this before. And UDP just adds to IP a data checksum for a little bit of reliability. At least when you get a message, you know that it was not accidentally corrupted in transit. But it's still best effort, but it does provide port numbers for application addressing. Once the packet gets to a host, we need to know which application is going to get it. That's what port numbers are for. And then transmission control protocol, I probably will say that more times, but more often I'll just say TCP, adds to IP, not to UDP, to IP, the data checksum, reliable byte stream delivery, and flow and congestion control. And this part we'll not talk about but it also has port numbers. And really, for what we're going to be talking about in the next couple days, it's the port numbers that are that are the key thing that we got to get our heads around right now, along with the distinction between UDP and TCP. Okay, the other stuff is kind of below the covers for what we're doing now. Okay, so a port number is a 16-bit identifier, and we talked about before how the port numbers, some of the port numbers are so-called well-known ports. There's a global database that says port 80 ought to be used for World Wide Web, port 25 ought to be used for SMTP, port 23 ought to be used for Telnet, others are 22 for SSH, Secure Shell, 110 for POP, and there are other well-known ports associated with secure versions of many of these as well. So there's a bunch of those that are well-known. But generally, every host is free to use port numbers in any way that it wants to. If you violate these rules, you'll make life difficult for your customers, but the internet itself won't care. That's really the key thing here. Okay, so in the high-speed overview in Chapter 1, I mentioned sockets. And sockets are the programming interface to TCP. They're the way that programs can get their hands on the services provided by the network. It turns out that, that the sockets design also works for talking to other protocols that have nothing to do with TCP/IP, but they are the way that we talk to TCP/IP, and I would say that's mostly what they're used for. But okay, so what's the best way to do this? I really want that higher up on the screen. Can everybody see all the way to the bottom of the slide? No. Let's do this. Keep that. Close that. Well, it's higher up, it's smaller. Do the best we can here. Okay, so here's the deal. A TCP socket is a OS level. No, I can't. The problem is I can't write when it's in this form. All right, we'll go back to the other one and I'll help out after I get things written on here. So, TCP socket is a OS level, well, any socket. Concept. In order to create a socket, you make a system call to the operating system. Right? And what happens when you do that is the operating system creates a data structure internal to itself to record information about the socket. Okay. At the application level, The applications traffic back and forth with the operating system, talking about sockets, using file descriptors. Well, in Windows, socket descriptors. But in Linux programming, the gadgets that you use to talk about, to tell the operating system about what you want to do with a socket is just like a file descriptor. It's a small number. So and you can use some of the same calls on it that you use for a file descriptor. You can read and write it, for example. In Windows, they did it a little differently, and the socket descriptors are different from file descriptors. But that's okay. The ideas are still the same. Okay? Now, so here we are inside the operating system. And we've got some sockets, and every socket is associated with some port. Okay, so at the network layer, we have, right, we have ports and IP addresses. And so when a packet comes into the operating system from the IP layer, it will say it's either a TCP packet or a UDP packet. It will contain a port number in it as its destination, and it will get routed to some socket or other. Notice that, like file descriptors, sockets can be shared between different applications. So it still may not be the case that we know which application is going to get that message. It may just depend on which one tries first. Right? But we've satisfied our responsibility as the operating system by getting it to the correct socket, and then after that it's up to the applications to keep their act straight about who reads it first. Similar thing happens over on the UDP side. Okay, so the key thing is across the OS layer boundary, we have sockets and file descriptors. And below the, sort of outside the box, this is the box boundary. And here we have the network. We have ports and IP addresses. And so the job of the operating system, in some sense, is to take things that come in saying one thing over there about port and protocol and IP address, and route it to the correct socket. Okay? But keep it straight that ports and sockets are not the same thing. That's really the main thing here. Okay, how do you get a socket? Now we really get toward doing programming. The principal initial way of getting a socket is to make a socket system call. And you have to tell it a few things. You have to say what remember I said the sockets work with a whole bunch of things besides the internet. But what we're doing is going to be the internet. So the family, as far as the sockets interface, is called the Internet Protocol Family. PF stands for Protocol Family. And you will, when you look in the book, you'll see that there are a set of include files that you include at the beginning of your program that will define all these constants. right? So you never put in an actual number here. You always use the pound defined constant. Okay? The type distinguishes between stream sockets and datagram sockets, and again, there are predefined constants that do that, that get passed to the type field of the socket call. And similarly, there are constants naming TCP and UDP as the actual protocols. Now, it turns out that there are some variants. There are some other protocols that can be passed as for the stream protocol or the datagram protocol, but we're not going to use them. All right, and we'll just be using TCP or UDP. Okay, so the result of calling socket is a small number in Unix, just like a file descriptor, and in Windows, it's what's called a socket handle, which isn't a file handle, but you use it in the same way when you do the socket calls. Okay. So, where are we headed here? We're trying to figure out how to set up communication with an app on another host. Okay, that's what we're that's the big top level picture of what we're trying to do. The first thing we have to do is have a socket to do it. Next thing we have to do is we have to be able to say something about the address of that other application. Okay? And that's what this next slide is about. It's about the programming data structures that are used to specify addresses. We'll see how the addresses are used in the next slide. But before we can do that, we have to say, how do we specify the address of another host? And the key data structure is struct socadder in. Socadder is apparent what that stands for. In here stands for internet, not inbound. Okay, so a socket address. So let's be clear here. The socket number is an operating system level concept that allows you to specify in your application what socket I'm talking about. All right? That's what we did on the previous slide. Now, the socket itself is going to be associated with some internet address and port number. That's what we're talking about now. Okay? So this is going to be, how do we tell the operating system what other host and port we want this socket to be associated with? Okay? So we only do that once, but this is what we've got to tell it. We've got to tell it that it's a internet address. Don't quite know why we have to tell it again after having said that it was a internet family socket. But anyway, we do. We have to say it's a internet address. It has a certain port number, and it has a certain 32-bit address associated with it. Okay? And then because this general socadder structure is big enough for other kinds of address, we have 8 bytes of nothing. Okay? So this is what it looks like if you lay it out in memory. So this is the way that programs talk about internet addresses. They traffic in these socketerians. We talked about clients and servers before. Clients actively make connections. Servers passively wait to respond. That's clear. So let's go through the whole scheme of what a program does now to set itself up to connect or to communicate with another process, application. I'm going to do the server side first, I guess. We make a call to the socket system call, saying it's an internet stream TCP. Always, hopefully you've learned, check your system calls for success. Don't just plow on when they return negative values, but rather report the error. Okay. So that gets us a socket. Notice at this point it has nothing associated with it. We haven't said anything about what IP address is associated with it or anything else. Well, actually, we're not going to say anything about the IP address for this one. Now, next thing we have to do is we have to tell this socket that it ought to be associated with either a particular port or let the operating system choose a port for it. Okay? So that's what happens in the next call. The next call is actually bind, which says associate a local port with our socket. All right, and here's where this struct socketer in comes into play. We build a struct socketer in, saying that's an internet family address, and we tell it that we're willing to accept any old address that you want to use, and we're going to actually specify the port. Okay, so this inadder any is a sort of wild card that says to the operating system, I don't care what IP address you associate with this, pick one. Well, which one is it going to pick? It's going to pick the IP addresses associated with this host. Okay, so that's part one. Part two is we're actually going to pick a particular port to use for our application, and I guess we've at some point defined a numerical value for that. Next thing, what is this about? Underline the little bits of it. There's a keyword to living inside this. This stands for host to network long, host to network short. We'll talk about this more later, but the issue is that some processors use natively big endian numbers, that is the high order byte has the lower address in memory, and other processors use little endian where the low order byte has the lower address in memory. Okay, and in order to make networking work, we have to agree on what by what order the bytes of numbers come in. Otherwise, people won't understand. There'll be confusion. So network byte order is big endian. And these two, and there are two more besides, H2NL, H2NS, are macros that rearrange the bytes of numbers so they're in the right order for the network. And on big endian machines, they don't have to do anything, and on little endian machines, they have to flip the order of the bytes. And it's unfortunate that the API is defined such that this is a client responsibility, but it is. That's how it worked. Okay, so these three assignments are setting up the internet address port and internet address and port to get ready to pass them to the bind system call. So this is the bind system call. And see, we pass it the server socket and the address and the size of the address. And again, we check to make sure that it succeeded. Okay? Now, next step. The server is going to sort of passively sit here and wait for clients to show up, right? The server, that's what we said before. The server is pretty passive. Once it's set up the fact that I'm a server, it just needs to be ready for clients to show up and make requests. And that's done with the listen system call. So we've done socket, bind, now we do listen, which says to the operating system, I'm now ready to have things make connections to this port and I'll take care of what happens after that. Okay? So that's just a advice to the operating system to listen. This max pending number is how many pending clients can exist before the OS rejects connection attempts. All right. So that's just a small number typically that says, you know, if there are a lot of people that want to talk to me and I'm not able to keep up with them, then operating system, you go ahead and tell them to go away. I don't want to have to deal with them. I don't want to make them wait. Just get them out of here, out of my way. Okay, so we're about a third of the way through this pattern. We've got the server listening for connections, and next time we need to look at how you program the behavior after that to accept connections, communicate, and close, and we need to look at the system call pattern that we use on the clients in order to make those connections to the server. Okay? So, any questions at this point? Okay? Well, then I'll see you on Monday. Turn in your homework. If you have an issue about the homework, let me know. All right? That'll do.